A young perspective on hot button issues around the world. This is The Hub.
Hello and welcome to The Hub. I'm Wang Guan in Beijing. Today, our eyes are on Chinese Premier Li Qiang as he delivers the government work report. The document is about the overall direction for economic, social, and foreign policy for the year 2024. As China is focusing on new productive forces, what will be some of this year's main growth drivers? How will China navigate through domestic and international challenges? To discuss all these, I'm pleased to be joined by Robert Ross, professor of political science at Boston College and an associate at the Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies at Harvard University. Professor Ross, about the same time last year at Nanjing University, you said you would take a pulse of the Chinese economy. Now that we're 1 year into your speech, where do you think the Chinese economy is? What is your diagnosis?
Well, when one looks at the Chinese economy, clearly it's having difficulties today. And part of it simply stems from a post-COVID recession that many countries experience. The Chinese people are saving after having spent a lot of money during the recession. So the domestic stimulus is missing. And of course, the globe, much of the globe is in recession. So Chinese exports are down. So I would expect in the short term that Chinese exports would grow and consumption would grow and China's economy would begin to grow again. It's just a matter of time, plus the stimulus the Chinese government is carrying out. Over the longer term, we do have to worry about the lack of productivity gains in the Chinese economy. Productivity has been stagnant for the last 10 years. So that makes it very difficult for the Chinese economy to grow. And then second, of course, there is the large debt problems in the Chinese economy. Going forward, there's going to be a question of how much confidence the private sector has in the economy, whether the state sector can reinvest as well to increase productivity.
Professor Ross, I'm so glad you talked about productivity. At the end of the day, most economists would say that it's all about productivity gains that can really boost up the economy, help the labor force. President Xi Jinping recently proposed this new concept, new productive forces, that he thought should be in full play to help the Chinese economy get to the next level, you know, quality over quantity, the new productive forces. What's your understanding of this concept and how do you see that becoming a reality?
Well, I think President Xi would like to bolster the further technological advancement of the Chinese economy in manufacturing and production. That will more than compensate for any concerns about the demographic problems China allegedly faces. I don't believe China's problems are demographic. China has more than enough people, more than enough workers. It simply needs to find ways to increase productivity by implementing more technology into the workplace. The stagnation in productivity over the last 10 years is a problem, and there's going to have to be greater confidence for private sector to invest and greater confidence for startups to invest, and we'll see whether that can happen.
You know, Professor Ross, there are so many analysts talking about the Chinese economy. Some say that the Chinese economy has peaked, a voice echoed again and again and again in Davos recently. But other analysts on a more positive note think that China is the new China and there is a certain level of resistance in the Chinese economy, in the Chinese manufacturing base and the Chinese labor force. Which camp do you belong to?
I think peak is the wrong word. There are a lot of opportunities for continued Chinese growth. The question is not whether China continues to grow, but how fast it grows. I don't think China will have a problem once it comes out of this recession at growing at 4 to 5% a year. And of course, on a global basis, that's a rather rapid growth of the largest market in the world. So the idea of China peaking, I think, is rather misplaced. China wants to grow at 5, 6, 7%. It's going to have to have that new industrialization, that new technology. But in either case, China hasn't peaked.
And then judging from the performance of the Chinese economy in the past year, we do see a whole range of challenges ranging from sluggish consumption to not exactly exiting of foreign companies, but really a lack of a reinvestment of foreign enterprises, multinational companies based in Greater China. Why do you think that's the case and how do you think the policies can be fine-tuned to really help boost the confidence of consumers, investors alike?
Well, the decline in foreign investment in China reflects multiple factors. One is simply the slowdown in growth in China. So the opportunities for investment are simply less. And so that's just natural. I think if China starts to grow again at 4 or 5%, the attraction of the Chinese market will return and investment will go back up again. But then second, we do have the geopolitical problems, and American companies, European countries, are worried about political risk, they're worried about government opposition, and they're worried about, in both countries, I should say, there's growing concern over security. In America, we talk about TikTok, we talk about other things, Huawei, security factors. And of course, the Chinese government is concerned about security too. And this also creates concern among European American companies for investment in China. But I think once the Chinese market begins to grow again, there'll be a renewed investment in China.
Professor Ross, you talk about security. President Joe Biden recently targeted the Chinese companies, the EV companies, electric vehicle companies. By the way, as you know, China is the largest manufacturer of electric vehicles, more EVs rolling out of Chinese production lines than anywhere in the world. Can you help explain what is the rationale behind President Biden's latest policy, and how will that policy unfold?
Well, I think President Biden is focused on the Chinese technology industries as the major force of the rise of China. And he's concerned about the rise of China and the challenge to American global leadership. And so there are various technologies, various companies, various sectors that we're trying to compete with. And one of them is electric cars, solar panels and wind turbines and climate change technologies. And so there is a incentive, or I should say an interest in the United States in simply slowing Chinese growth. Of course, this is a contradiction for American climate policy, because when so doing, we're undermining America's effort to have a cleaner environment because as you say, Chinese cars are less expensive, your e-cars, and they're very popular around the world. And so should the United States prioritize climate change, we would be letting more Chinese cars into the United States with lower tariffs.
Professor Ross, China's two sessions, known as MPC and CPPCC, are ongoing. What are the things that you're looking for this year's Chinese two sessions?
I think, as always, the major agenda item is going to be the Chinese economy and what President Xi plans to do to stimulate the economy. Western observers would like to see more, but I do think China has a step-by-step approach. It doesn't want to rush into too much stimulus, too many policies at once, to do what's necessary. After all, this is how the American Federal Reserve Bank approached American inflation, step by step. And so I would expect there would be more stimulus from China, and I look forward to the NPC telling us the direction that Xi Jinping plans to go to revive Chinese economic growth.
And what role do you expect AI to play as a potential new force of the Chinese economy?
Well, I think both the United States, China, Europe, other countries are very interested in AI as the next step in technology, the next step in productivity gains. United States, Europe, Japan are all experiencing demographic challenges. And if AI can speed up growth, despite the lower populations, I think there's a lot of optimism about that. In China as well, this is a cutting-edge technology. China wants to remain involved in artificial intelligence to have cutting-edge technologies for global exports and for technology development.
Finally, Professor Ross, what do you think are the bright spots, the positives of the Chinese economy, now that we've heard so much about the negatives of the Chinese economy?
The Chinese have great universities. Their innovative skills are quite strong. There's a strong work ethic in China. And so if the Chinese can put together the right policies to stimulate the economy and move China into the next technological generation for in industry and factories, I think many would be quite optimistic that the Chinese people can continue to move forward at a rapid pace. But again, regardless of what happens over the next 5 to 10 years, I think China can sustain a 4 to 5% growth. And many, many countries around the world, including the United States and European countries and Japan, would be quite pleased with the 4 to 5% annual growth.
Professor Ross, it's so good to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The economic scene is dealing with some new hurdles like decoupling and supply chain disruptions. Is there a way out of this maze? Let's hear from Christopher Pissarides, Economic Nobel Prize laureate and a Regius Professor of Economics at London School of Economics. Welcome to the Hub on CGTN. IMF recently predicts that decoupling and disruption of industrial and supply chains may cost the global GDP some 5%, which is significant. And under the concept of open development, what kind of mechanism do you think can be adopted to reduce trade frictions and protectionism and to really stabilize the global industrial chain?
I quite believe that actually, because What's happened was that before, manufacturers, multinationals, generally people in business were looking at the global economy. You know, they were looking at different countries and thinking, which country will have the best comparative advantage for what I want to do? You know, how can I make sure I locate in such and such a country, because given what I'm producing and given the institutional structure of that country, is the best for my company. Now, they are not thinking like that, and I think that's what the IMF is getting at. What they're thinking is, if I do that, am I going to be surprised by any policy changes? Am I going to have any disruptions because of political considerations, or even, you know, as in the pandemic, am I going to see lockdowns that surprise me and get disruption? And as a result, and especially using the new technologies that make it more possible to do that, they're bringing production back home. It's called onshoring instead of offshoring. And even if they don't, they're looking at...
And people have been talking about friendshoring recently, you know, trusting your allies and partners.
Exactly, that's
and
what
ideologically
I was going to say.
Close
well done. Well done. You stole my word. I was going to say, well, there is friendshoring in the sense that, you know, for example, an American might say, well, do I need to go to Asia or should I just look at Mexico very carefully first because they're part of NAFTA? A European, you know, a German might say, well, could I offshore in Romania or Bulgaria, which still have low wages, other countries that that maybe have some of the benefits of some of the Asian countries I was going to, because I know they're within the European Union and I shouldn't expect any surprises. Once you think like that, you start restricting your domain, you're restricting all the possibilities that are open to you. And inevitably, the outcome will be worse than it was before.
You served as president of the European Economic Association, and in 2024, you will become the president of the Royal Economic Society. What's your hopes and suggestions for China-EU relations going forward, especially on the economic front? Will trade ties between leading economies in the global, you know, in those regions be further affected by growing geopolitical tensions?
Well, China-EU relations, I mean, I hope they continue improving. Ever since the 1980s, when China opened up and became a key player in globalization, European countries have benefited a lot. I mean, to give you two examples, Germany benefited a lot, became a major exporter of heavy engineering, luxury manufacturing products, vehicles, and so on to China. It benefited from locating in China and so on. Greece, which is my cultural origins, if you like, I am
awesome.
Of Greek origins, has benefited a lot by Chinese investment in the port of Athens, famous port that goes back at least 2,500 years, and it was declining. Chinese came in. It works very efficiently now. We're benefiting from that. I'm sure China is benefiting a lot from European technology that the multinationals that are locating, they're taking. I'm a regular participant at the China Development Forum, where the very top of European business is present. And we talk about it, and there is discussion, and there is a lot of interest from Chinese leaders. I don't like it when I see budding conflicts arising. For example, in the case of electric vehicles, I can see the European point, and I can see what they're saying. And I can also see what China is doing to promote its electric vehicle manufacturing. In Europe, governments are not allowed to subsidize industry because they want to have an open competition amongst all the members. Now, here we have two major world economies, the single European economy and China, following different principles in developing a new industry. Where should they start fighting and arguing and putting trade barriers against each other? No, they should sit down with an open mind, see how can they can reach a compromise and how they can progress forward, because both of us will benefit if we do that. So I'm hoping, I'm keeping my fingers crossed. I trust that people will see the reality of where we are and what benefits there are, and we'll move forward. But as we said before, you cannot be 100% sure about these things when geopolitics enters the equation.
Yeah, talking about the global economy, quantitative easing and fiscal stimulus measures have been following the financial meltdowns. If you think about 2008, 2009, but it has, you know, argued by many economists, it has failed to address the structural and systemic macroeconomic challenges, such as weak investment and mounting debt vulnerabilities. What do you think should be the priorities to reverse this trend, this downward spiral?
I don't think monetary policy like quantitative easing and so on should be addressed at investment. Investment is a real problem in the economy. It is a problem. We'd like to have more investment. We'd like to have more high-tech investment, but it's not something that monetary policy can do. Even fiscal policy, actually, although some types of fiscal policy will be helpful. The way to do it is to, for the government to do, is to provide a very good infrastructure. Now technologies are moving into the digital era, you know, provide a good digital infrastructure everywhere in the country, give incentives like tax incentives to the investors, make sure that you open up your economy to the outside world without the trade restrictions, encourage investment in human capital through good education, good training programs, encourage collaboration, don't regulate too much, but make sure that privacy and other personal concerns are protected, and then the entrepreneurial spirit will get you there. The government, the way I see it, is to provide a good framework within which individual initiatives could work and invest. Not try and manipulate too much, especially through monetary policy, which should really be used to address monetary factors like inflation and debt, not real investment. It's obviously not an easy task, but there's been a lot of work in this. We economists work on it day and night, some of us at least, and we do have rules of good, proper policy that will give the right incentives. And that's what we should be pursuing.
Yeah, we have many crises at hand. For example, inflationary pressures, a food crisis for many countries in the global south that happened ever since the pandemic, and the situation is obviously worsened by the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and now escalation of crisis between Palestine and Israel is hurting global demand and creating uncertainties. What kind of policy mix do you advise at this juncture?
We're in a very difficult juncture, actually, with the macroeconomic policy, because there are different problems. To take two examples from what you just mentioned, if you look at the pandemic, then governments rightly spend money out of public funds to support the private economy, because the lockdown was a very big negative shock on it. That was the right thing to do. You didn't want your economy to collapse completely. Now, at the end of the pandemic, the right policy to do is to reduce those debts and reduce the inflation by following a tighter monetary policy, you know, increase interest rates, take in money in circulation, replace it with assets, you know, through open market operations, so on and so forth. That's a kind of a straightforward policy to do. But then, at the end of the pandemic, superimpose on that the Ukraine situation, and what happens? You are faced with, at least from the European point of view, the way we see it, you are faced with higher prices of energy and food. There is an adjustment in relative prices that those necessities, the energy we need to run our industry, to heat our homes, the cost of that goes up, the cost of food goes up, and that, of course, feeds into the price of goods and gives you more inflation. Now, do you respond to that through tightened monetary policy? The answer is no, because it's not a general monetary expansion that you are going to take money away from the economy. If you did that, you will create a recession. You get a recession because the cost of energy is high, and you get another recession because of tight monetary policy. What you do, unfortunately, is not very comforting for people to hear, but you grin and bear it. You say, there is nothing I can do. Energy in the near future, at least, is going to be more expensive. We are committed to zero carbon emissions. Push forward in that. We haven't been good at that. We've been misbehaving. We go to meetings and say, yes, of course, we'll do it. There will be no more carbon emissions. And then we go back home and say, actually, it's very difficult to move as fast as they were saying. Let's take it more slowly. No, move fast. And that's how you deal with it, with other measures, with structural measures, because that's the Ukraine war and the prices in those materials have given rise to structural shifts in the economy that are not favorable.
Talking about the Chinese economy, Professor, China has held a high-level financial meeting chaired by the Chinese president, attended by senior leadership and policymakers in China. It says China would set up a mechanism for resolving local debt risks and managing local government debt. It also has launched a bunch of measures supporting corporate financing demand in the public and private sectors, you know, boosting its sluggish housing real estate sector. Are these appropriate and adequate ways to address China's current economic situation?
I think it's an adequate way of moving forward to bring everyone together and discuss, because the problem is getting rather complicated. China, I think, needs a structural change on financing and finances, especially local authorities. They relied a lot on selling land for their financing. We had the typical features of a bubble. Prices were going up and up. All the participants involved were benefiting, so no one wanted to stop it. Local authorities were getting more and more money because the price of land was going up. Those who bought before were gaining. Others wanted to go in and buy. And it's a typical situation of a bubble, which we've seen so many times in the housing market. A collapse was bound to come, and it came. Now, the things that need to be done are, first of all, the housing market needs to be fixed. Without fixing the housing market, given what an enormous part of private wealth it accounts for, and how important it's been for local authorities. If you don't fix the market to have it as a regular working market for a very important commodity, housing services, you are not going to solve the debt problem and the other financing problems. The other one is that local authorities should get it out of their mode of thinking that if I need money, I'm going to sell a little bit more land, because that's going to create more speculation and bubbles. They should think, what services do I need to provide, and how do I fund those services? Mm-hmm. That I appreciate is a lot more difficult than it is.
Professor, your research on search and matching theory has been widely quoted in the academic circles, especially in labor economics, where it has to be used to describe the formation of new jobs, and you've also taught in Chinese universities. So what do you make of China's younger generation? How could they be better adapted to enter the job market? How should they prepare themselves for future global competition?
I'm very impressed, actually, by the willingness of the Chinese younger generation to get more education, to think about getting into entrepreneurship, starting businesses. I've been to many, many forums of young people in China where there is a lot of interest. I can see from the way they're asking me. What I advise them to do is not to specialize too much at a young age. It's not like the old days, you could do it and get away with it. You know, you become an accountant and you stay an accountant for the rest of your life, kind of thing, or a manufacturer. This is not the current situation. Learn some skills. Learn to understand data. Data is going to be everything in the future. You know, the ones who know how to use the massive amounts of data that we're getting are the ones that are going to succeed in whatever they want to do. IT, obviously, but I don't have to teach the Chinese about IT. The way everyone is looking at their phones, wherever they are, shows that they have quite a lot of comprehension. I wish occasionally they would look up a little bit more, yeah, because you also have beautiful nature.
They should read more books and work out more, huh?
That's another issue. Yeah, learn skills related to that. Learn also how to work with other people, how to communicate well with other people. Communication technologies and communications are going to be important, because as machinery is taking over and over, more tasks that can be mechanized, people, highly educated, successful people, will succeed through communication with other people, providing services to other people, seeing what they want, seeing in which direction to go, because ultimately the economy will move in the direction that its people want. You know, if there is no demand for something, you're not going to succeed by producing it. So focus on skills, learn general skills.
As we've just celebrated the 10th anniversary of the Belt and Road Initiative, how do you see the BRI changing the landscape of global development and globalization?
Well, actually, 10 years ago, I was in China when it was launched. I was so excited, so trying to find out. I was puzzled why it was called Belt and Road. But anyway, all that now is history. The Belt and Road Initiative actually was very good because of, if you like, returning all those surpluses that China made in its trade balance and sending it back to the world in the form of infrastructure investment. Obviously, you could never expect that absolutely everything will be successful in an investment. You know, it's not investment, it's a risky business. But there are investments in less developed countries that didn't have the funds, their governments or big businesses there didn't have the funds to provide good infrastructure investment. I mentioned the port of Athens, for example, that where lots of Chinese investment came in, that was part of the Belt and Road. There are investments in Pakistan, from what I know, in Africa, where they were desperately in need of these investments. Good infrastructure investment is absolutely essential if we're going to get the private initiative to invest more and have good rates of return and succeed. And what the Belt and Road Initiative does in its own way is to provide that infrastructure investment. It was very, very good. Beneficial for many, many countries, let me put it that way.
Professor Christopher Pissarides, thank you so much. Hope to see you again in China, and take care.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And that will do it for this edition of The Hub on CGTN. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Wang Guan in Beijing. I'll see you again next time.
We all enter this world with a universal greeting. We then learn to speak.
Bonjour, comment allez-vous?
Dobré outre.
Hoy estoy muy contenta.
Though our languages, cultures, and traditions may differ, we still share one thing in common. We have hope for humanity and the world.
German railway company Deutsche Bahn,
the 26th United Nations Climate Change.
Hear the difference. Join our global network to connect with the world.